This is John Daly. The program you're about to hear concerns an inquiry. An inquiry into a matter touching the question of life and death. You are invited to serve.
The American Broadcasting Company and United Nations Radio present The Great Dilemma, a special program concerning the problem of disarmament, its compulsions and its complexities, its past, its present, and its future. The Great Dilemma, featuring Francis L. Sullivan as the first witness. Here again is Mr. John Daly.
Now for the inquiry. First, the terms of reference. Put it this way. The problem of disarmament has been on various international agendas for several decades. Statesmen, political thinkers, and delegates plenipotentiary have put forward hundreds of plans, proposals, and resolutions. Thousands of speeches have been made, and many millions of words have been spoken. On the slate of time, nations have been, for years now, working hard at the complex arithmetic of war and peace in an effort to reach that final, that elusive equation where armed security is balanced by disarmed peace, where life can be protected by something better than the fear of death. But the equation, the solution, still eludes us. And today, two new and powerful multiplication factors loom behind the unresolved arithmetic of war and peace. Fission and fusion, A-bombs and H-bombs. Have these made the solution easier or more difficult? Where do we stand today? There, then, you have your terms of reference. Open up the inquiry, then.
Let us begin by throwing a backward glance at those now silent years of unrewarded effort and ask, what kind of message do they have for us? Summon to mind the first witness. Your name, please.
I am known by many names. Cynic, skeptic, scoffer. But I speak in the name of history. Call me a realist.
Well, we'd rather not prejudge the issue. The inquiry has just begun. Let your name go unrecorded for the moment. Your testimony.
I fear, sir, that you'll not like what I have to say.
Our mind is open. The floor is yours. Tell us the worst. Perhaps that, in the end, will be the best.
What I have to say, Mr. Chairman, can be said in a few sad words. Philosophically, sir, the vision of a world disarmed and of peace, a world which would beat its swords into plowshares, is an ancient one. It is still no more than a vision. It has been preached by all the great religions of the world. They are still preaching it. It has been sought by men of noble mind in all countries and in all ages. They are still seeking it. Politically also, Mr. Chairman, the idea of disarmament has a long history. The efforts of men to lay down weapons of war began way back in the bow and arrow days. Forgive me for introducing a little bit of erudition, but I think you may find the information of interest.
Yes, by all means, please go on.
Way back in 1139, an interdict was issued by a source of high authority, the Second Lateran Church Council. It said,
certain weapons, to wit the crossbow and arch, are deadly and odious to God. Their use is henceforth interdicted and forbidden.
Exactly. Ever since then, Mr. Chairman, men have been trying to lay down ever-improving versions of the crossbow and the arch. They have had peace conferences, disarmament conferences, and declarations of pious purpose. But what is the net result? Today we have a stockpile of arms larger and surely more deadly and more odious to God than ever before. Our ability to destroy ourselves today is matched only by our ability to deceive ourselves into thinking that disarmament is possible.
You live up to your warning, sir, and I find you don't conceal your realism under any bushels. But perhaps you'll explain to us why you've reached the conclusion that disarmament is not possible.
The reason for this unpleasant conclusion, Mr. Chairman, lies in the nature of arms and in their value to states. Arms, sir, are instruments of war. As such, they are useful, indeed indispensable, for states in times of war. This much is obvious. But what is not quite so obvious, and what we generally fail to recognize, is that arms have an equally great, if not greater, usefulness for states in times of peace. The fact is that nations build arms not only to put them into the hands of their soldiers, but even more so into the hands of their diplomats.
That's an interesting, though also a somewhat disturbing thought, sir.
Let's face the facts, Mr. Chairman. The art of successful diplomacy depends not only upon the soundness and persuasiveness of your arguments, but also upon the hardness and persuasiveness of your military hardware. This being so, how can any nation really be expected to disarm?
I see, but aren't you ignoring the fact that there have, after all, been some successful disarmament agreements in the past?
And not since 600 BC, Mr. Chairman. It is true that in that year, 2,500 years ago, the Chinese states of the Yangtze Valley formed a disarmament league which lasted for about 100 years. But there has been nothing since then which you could call a general disarmament agreement in any sense.
Nothing nearer our own times?
Nearer our own times, sir. There were only the naval treaties signed in Washington and in London during the second and third decades of this century. These merely fixed ratios for the five major naval powers of the day. The United States, the United Kingdom, France, Italy, and Japan. Also, in 1925, there was the Geneva Protocol, which prohibited the use, though not the manufacture, of gas and bacterial weapons. So you see that these were limited and restricted agreements which scarcely deserve the name of disarmament.
Yes, but limited though they were, sir, they were, after all, disarmament agreements. What would you say was the reason for these limited successes?
I suppose, Mr. Chairman, the reason was just plain, calculated self-interest. In certain circumstances and under certain conditions, I suppose, nations have more to gain than to lose by entering into certain agreements. And so they do.
Thank you, sir. You may step down. Your testimony has been lucid and helpful.
Oh, you're quite welcome, I'm sure.
We proceed with the inquiry now and see if self-interest today works for or against disarmament. Will the next witness take the stand, please?
Mr. Chairman, I should like to speak, if I may, of money. Mad money. Mad thermonuclear money.
Well, go right ahead, sir.
Sir, I needn't take much of your time. My story, like that of the last witness, can be briefly told. But if I may say so, it also makes more sense. Briefly, then, the position is that the world so far has been spending sums of money on armaments which have run into billions, but which have still been, in a way, within the compass of arithmetical calculation and comprehension. But today, a new algebra is at work, an algebra of destruction, A for atomic, and H for hell. This new algebra has taken the world beyond the frontiers of arithmetical comprehension into a region where war speaks the Greek of megatons and where economics follows at its peril. From the economic point of view, the money spent on armaments has always represented a thieving from the treasury of life for the purposes of death. But today, in order to feed the ravenous appetites of the nuclear and thermonuclear war apparatus, nations must not only steal from the treasury of life, they must ransack it wholesale. Theft is no longer enough. Only a mass robbery can support these weapons of mass destruction.
You use strong words, sir.
You mean words like stealing, theft, robbery? Fortunately, I have authority for using them. The highest authority. Listen, sir, to President Eisenhower.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
And with this thought, Mr. Chairman, With this thought, and just one other, I seek your permission to surrender the witness stand. The purpose of all these vast and wasteful armament expenditures is to provide security. Security against the fear of death in war. But, sir, there is no nation and no economic system on earth which can long continue the self-defeating process of guarding against death by cheating life. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Economics has spoken. Now, who else wishes to take the witness stand?
Hi, sir. I should like the hearing.
Well, this way to the stand, sir.
Thank you.
And in whose name do you speak?
Largely common sense, I think, Mr. Chairman. But if that isn't imposing enough, put me down as speaking in the name of politics. I wish to challenge statements made here by your first witness in the name of realism and of history. I think I can show that we have reached a point where arms have achieved such destructive perfection that, ironically, they have destroyed their own value, both military and political.
You may proceed, sir.
From the point of view of the political significance of war, sir, you may say that the world has passed through five broad historical stages. In the beginning, killing was an individual act of precision. You got your enemy one man at a time. Then came the stage of small-scale group killing, when new inventions made it possible to bring down more than one man with one blow. At the turn of this century, other inventions followed, and we passed from what you might call the cottage industry process of manufacturing death to truly mass production methods. These were tried out during World Wars I and II. In 1945, however, the fourth, you might say the penultimate stage of warfare arrived with the atomic bomb. This was a huge step forward in the industrialization of death, and it called for deep new thinking on the subject of war and its place in the political calculations of nations. But we didn't get the chance to think long. On the 1st of November 1952, with the explosion of the first hydrogen bomb, the world entered an entirely new era. It passed from A to H, alphabetically only a third of the way through to the end, but in terms of war, right at the end for all practical purposes. Permit me, Mr. Chairman, to cite certain calculations made by an eminent engineer diplomat concerning the military significance of the H-bomb. Witness, Monsieur Jules Mock, French representative on the UN's Disarmament Commission.
A single thermonuclear bomb would be enough to destroy the city of Paris completely, to ravage the much more widespread city of New York, and devastate the whole of Greater London. If 6,000 atomic bombs adequately dispersed would have to be dropped in France in order that the entire population should feel the effect more or less seriously, the same result could be achieved with only 15 thermonuclear bombs.
Mr. Chairman, most of us still live in the atomic age, both when we think of the destructiveness and the political significance of war and the threat of war. But the atomic age, sir, was yesterday. And that, in this case, was a very long time ago. Whether we know it or not, we have made the great transition. Recall, if you will, Mr. Chairman, the way that Sir Winston Churchill put it in one of his last speeches as Prime Minister. Quote,
"There is an immense gulf between the atomic and the hydrogen bombs. The atomic bomb, with all its terror, did not carry us outside the scope of human control or manageable events in thought or action, in peace or war. But with the hydrogen bomb, the entire foundation of human affairs has been revolutionized, and mankind placed in a situation both measureless and laden with doom."
Unquote. And, sir, the matter doesn't end here. Having achieved the ultimate by way of weapons, nations are now working on the ultimate by way of delivering them to the target. This adds new symbols to the algebra of catastrophe. To the A and H of weapons, you may soon add the ICBM of delivery, the intercontinental ballistic missile. We are informed, sir, that this is potentially the most effective delivery system that can be imagined. We are told that it will travel at many times the speed of sound and reach from one continent to another in a matter of minutes, almost instantaneously. We are about to enter the age of push-button annihilation.
But surely, sir, you're presenting only one side, the gruesome side of the picture. Surely the science which produces these weapons will also know how to provide a defense against them. After all, throughout history, each new weapon has led to a parallel defense.
Permit me, Mr. Chairman, just three brief quotations in reply. They are from the highest authorities. First, Monsieur Jules Mock.
For the first time in the history of humanity, we are confronted by the spectacle of a thrust to which there is no parry, of defense methods helpless in the face of attack.
And now some words of Sir Winston Churchill.
There is no absolute defense against the hydrogen bomb.
And finally, the words and voice of President Eisenhower.
Let no one think that the expenditure of vast sums for weapons and systems of defense can guarantee absolute safety for the cities and citizens of any nation.
And that is the military situation in this thermonuclear age. And it has a most fundamental bearing on the subject of disarmament. It means, no less, that whatever political purposes wars may have served in the past, today their political value is over. Why? Listen to some recent words of Sir Anthony Eden.
Wars in the past have often begun because one power, or combination of powers, has believed its forces sufficient to win and hold some overwhelming advantage. Sometimes their ambition has brought them victory. It can never do so in this nuclear age, when oblivion confronts aggressor and victim alike.
This prospect, Mr. Chairman, the prospect of mutual annihilation, constitutes the new fact of international life today. And you can put this fact down, sir, as the most powerful item of national, of international self-interest working in favor of disarmament.
Ah, but hold on now, sir, not so fast. How do you draw that conclusion? It may well be that atomic wars have become too totally destructive. And therefore it may well be that they cannot any longer figure in the thinking of nations as a means of pursuing political aims. But does this necessarily mean that there is today a greater incentive for disarmament? May it not be that the logic really flows the other way? There are many, you know, who argue that modern weapons, the weapons you've been talking about, are so absolutely destructive that they themselves are the best guarantee of peace. How about that view?
I know, sir, that there are many who think this way. There are many who feel that by producing the H-bomb, the world has achieved a sort of paradoxical solution to the disarmament problem. I recognize the thinking. I know it is not uncommon. But the point I wish to stress is, and this is important, that such reasoning forms no part of the officially announced thinking of governments. Whatever their views on the deterrent value of H-bombs, no government regards the existence of the bombs as a sufficient guarantee of peace. On the contrary, there are too many risks involved, too many possibilities of the deterrent not working. Sir Winston Churchill mentions two such possibilities, lunacy and despair.
The deterrent does not cover the case of lunatics or of dictators in the mood of Hitler when he found himself in his final dugout.
And Monsieur Mock raises another possibility, miscalculation.
Who can certify that criminal governments will never make up their minds to forestall aggression by aggression and commit mass murder in order not to become the victims of mass murder?
Permit me, Mr. Chairman, to conclude my reply to the peace through the H-bomb theory with just two more quotations. Number one, in the words of Canada's Secretary of State for External Affairs, Mr. Lester B. Pearson.
Peace rests uneasily on one, even less easily on two hydrogen bombs.
And two, the words of Premier Nikolai Bulganin of the Soviet Union.
It is wrong to assert that inasmuch as East and West possess the hydrogen bomb, the possibility of a thermonuclear war is automatically excluded.
Is your question now answered, sir? May the peace through the H-bomb theory be laid at rest?
Your answer, sir, is noted, and I thank you. I think we may well close this second phase of our inquiry also and move on to the last. there remain for us only these questions to ask. What efforts have we made to reach a disarmament agreement? Where do we stand today? So summon now the last witness, a report from the United Nations.
The story of the disarmament effort in the United Nations, Mr. Chairman, is long, continuous, and intricate. I doubt if I would have the time, or you the patience, sir, to go through it all in any detail.
Well, as for patience, I believe I have some reserves that I may call upon. I'd just like to say that it would help our understanding if you were to concentrate less on the individual trees and more on the wood as a whole.
Well, that makes my task very much easier. For many years, sir, in fact, till the summer of 1955, the discussion seemed to be going around in two concentric circles, as it were. One circle formed by the question of controls and the other by timing.
Could you make that clearer, sir?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you might think of it as a type of chicken or egg proposition. Within one circle, the Western powers insisted that control must precede disarmament, and the Soviet Union argued that disarmament must precede control. In the second circle, the Soviet Union insisted that a prohibition of atomic weapons should be the first disarmament step, while the Western powers said it should be the last.
And was there any movement from these opposite positions?
In May 1955, Mr. Chairman, the Soviet Union formally accepted a compromise solution which had been proposed the previous year by France and the United Kingdom. The essence of this was that the three elements of disarmament, reduction of conventional weapons, prohibition of atomic weapons, and control for both, be combined in one comprehensive program proceeding by stages.
Ah, so the riddle, or at least a part of the riddle, seemed to have been answered.
But at this stage, Mr. Chairman, let me cite a paragraph from the Soviet memorandum of last summer when the compromise was accepted. The Soviet Union said,
"There are possibilities beyond the reach of international control for evasion and for organizing the clandestine manufacture of atomic and hydrogen weapons, even if there is a formal agreement on international control."
This paragraph, sir, became crucial in later developments. Last December, the United States representative, Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., accepting the point made by the Soviet Union, elaborated it in these words.
"The production of nuclear material has been underway for a decade, under no international control whatsoever. During all of this time, it has been possible to hide atomic weapons."
This position, as I have said, Mr. Chairman, was commonly acknowledged. But the United States and the Soviet Union drew different conclusions from it.
What were these conclusions, sir?
The Soviet Union asked that while detection devices are perfected, the agreed stages of disarmament should begin at once under a control system outlined by it last May and incorporated later in the Bulganin plan. This envisaged, as one of the measures of control, the stationing of international observers at key communication centers to guard against the possibility of a surprise massing of forces for attack. The United States, on the other hand, said the situation called for a new, fundamental, and extensive restudy of the whole question of international inspection and control. In the meantime, said the United States, all previous disarmament plans should be placed in reserve, and attention centered for the moment on the Eisenhower plan. This would have the United States and the Soviet Union exchange military blueprints and throw open their territories to their aircraft, which as peace sentinels, so to speak, would carry out mutual reconnaissance as a means of preventing a surprise attack. In the General Assembly last December, Mr. Lodge painted this picture of the purpose and value of the Eisenhower plan.
"This will make major surprise attack impossible because of the impossibility of concealing preparations for it. This will remove the menace of World War III.
The chief representative of the Soviet Union, Mr. V.V. Kuznetsov, for his part, accepted the sincerity of the Eisenhower plan, but questioned its value, unless it was linked with a disarmament program.
"If there is no previous agreement on the actual reduction of armaments and the prohibition of atomic weapons, the other party may well make use of this intelligence in order to increase its armed forces and stockpiles of armaments, including atomic weapons."
And that brings your story pretty much up to date, does it not?
Well, not quite, Mr. Chairman, though very nearly so. My account brings the situation up to the conclusion of the last session of the UN General Assembly. The Assembly, last December, urged the five nations principally involved, and that means the four major nations and Canada, to renew disarmament efforts, giving priority to both the Eisenhower and Bulgarian plans. The five nations are meeting in London for this very purpose, and there are hopes of further developments there. You recall, Mr. Chairman, the recent letter from President Eisenhower to Premier Bulganin suggesting the possibility, under the protective umbrella of the combined Eisenhower-Bulganin plans, of working out safeguards under which the future production of nuclear weapons could be halted and fissionable materials diverted to an international agency for peaceful purposes. Disarmament efforts at this stage, the President said, should concentrate on bringing the nuclear threat under control and on limiting major armaments rather than limiting military manpower. What has happened since then, and is happening, you don't need me to tell you. It is there, in the newspapers, on your doorstep.
Yes, that is so, sir, and I thank you for your account. Before you leave the stand, just one more question. This problem of disarmament has been on the international agenda for many decades. On the slate of time, we've put down 1 million words, and we've been working hard at 100 fervent equations. Why can't we break the deadlock? What central difficulty is it that defies solution? What is it that mocks the combined wisdom of the world's nations?
Pick up a piece of paper, sir, and write down this primary equation. Fear leads to armaments.
Mm-hmm.
And against this, write, armaments add to fear.
Yes, I've got that.
And now, sir, write down this other equation, equally primary. Disarmament needs trust. And against this one, note, disarmament enriches trust.
Yes, I understand that.
There, then, is your problem. Somewhere there, lurking within those interacting equations of fear and faith. Somewhere within those interacting equations, equations of faith and fear, Mr. Chairman, must also lie the answer.
Our inquiry has ended. Our inquiry into the problem of disarmament. Thank you for serving. The answer, that belongs to governments, to you, and to tomorrow. Till tomorrow, then, this is John Daly handing the gavel back to the United Nations.
You've been listening to The Great Dilemma with John Daly as host and featuring Francis L. Sullivan, Charles Corvin, Louis Van Ruten, and Charles Dryden. The program is produced and transcribed by the American Broadcasting Company and the international staff of United Nations Radio as the first of a series reviewing major issues before the world today.